this in your son's name. Amen.
Okay, very good.
May we have...
That's why.
Hey, John?
Yes.
How is Diane's leg, knee?
It's getting better. I'm doing the physical therapy, so usually I'm sore after that, but the next day I'm fine.
And she's not using her crutches anymore.
Yeah, cane.
Oh, good. Or,
I mean, cane.
I'm weaning myself from the cane, so.
Good.
So it's come along.
Prayer works.
Yeah, yep. Thank you.
Okay, we will not be meeting next week. The Andersons will be out of town, so thought I'd post that. And again, we'd like for continuing prayer for Oksana and her family. They're still in the Ukraine, close to the Polish border, and they're trying to get things settled, but Steve indicated that it's they're still in transition and haven't gotten a long-term place to stay. But keep them in your prayers as well. Okay, what we have looked at so far is the prologue of John, which basically is a quick run-through of biblical history from going back to God before creation and the relationship with between the Father and the Son in eternity past, going into creation, then the effects of the fall, and then the coming of John the Baptist and the coming of Jesus, where it says in verse 14 of chapter 1 that the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us, that is, among the disciples. And then we looked at the prologue of John. We looked at the introductory section where the witnesses are being introduced. John the Baptist testified, and his testimony led to three testimonies, one by Andrew, one by Philip, and one by Nathanael. So at the end of John chapter 1, we have six disciples, actually, three of whom did not give recorded testimonies in John chapter 1. But it was important for Jesus to collect these disciples because they would be witnesses of his signs. When we think about the purpose statement in John 20, 30 and 31, it says that Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples that were not recorded in the Gospel of John. But notice he says, in the presence of his disciples. What we are going to see in the passage that we're looking at tonight is the first of Jesus' signs, turning water into wine. As he did so, he had disciples who were witnesses of that and would be able to verify that indeed he did this sign along with the other seven signs that are recorded in John's Gospel. So the witnesses are an important aspect of John's Gospel, but now that they have been accumulated, he can move into showing the signs. Remember that purpose statement. Many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these, the eight signs, are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and by believing this, you may have life in his name. I emphasize the word you. It's very important in that passage because it tells us that the original readers had not yet believed and therefore did not yet have life. John's Gospel represents itself as presenting everything that is necessary to receive life, to receive eternal life. And 100 times in this Gospel, the word believe is used, but the word repent, penance, and so forth are never used, not once. But we looked last time at the four who testified. Now we're going to start with the first of the signs. However, we do have a continuation of here, and this does help to show that chapter 1, verses 15 through 51, belong to the same part of the outline as chapter 2, because notice where 2:1 starts, on the third day. So, what we have preceding that is a series of days. Let's assume for the sake of argument that the first day is Sunday. Now, as I indicate down at the bottom of the page, the sequence could be Sunday through Friday, Monday through Saturday, Tuesday through Sunday, and so on and so forth. Just for the simplicity's sake, we're assuming Sunday. So verses 15 through 28 are the first day. Notice then in verse 29, the next day. And this is John the Baptist testifying. Then the next day, verse 35, Andrew testifies. The next day, verse 43, this would be Wednesday under this scheme, Philip testifies. That same day, Nathanael gives testimony. There is nothing said specifically about the Thursday, but on the last day of the sequence, chapter 2, verse 1, on the third day. This is not saying the third day of the week in the sense of Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, but rather it is saying on the third day, that is not the next day, but the day after the next day, there was a wedding. In particular, there was a wedding feast. What we need to do at this time, though, is to set up some of the some understanding of what is going on in verse 1. That notice it says, verse 1, on the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And the location that this is given down in verse 11. This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. The Cana of Galilee is where Jesus' destination will be as he made plans to go up to Galilee. Look back at 143. The following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee. But now the question is, where is it that Jesus is starting from? Well, we find that in verse 28. These things were done in Bethany, beyond the Jordan, where John was baptizing. Bethany would be the best reading. Bethabara, which is in the Textus Receptus, is a reading that we reject. But Jesus is wanting to leave from Bethany, or Bethania, in verse 43, and we have his arrival in Cana of Galilee on the third day, chapter 2, verse 1. So what we need to see here is how much time is available for this trip. And you might say, why is that important? It bears significantly because the location of where Bethania is, or where Bethany is, what place is being identified or called Bethany, there's not a lot of time available because we only have a two-day gap, as we'll see here on this chart. This is looking back at chapter 1, again with the Sunday through Saturday scheme. On Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, he was in Bethania. On Wednesday, after finding Philip, then he left Bethania. Thursday would be a travel day. And he is in Cana of Galilee for the wedding. So where I have put the red box is the amount of time that's available for travel. It is not possible for the disciples to have gone a long distance to make a four-day trip in 2 days. That limits the options as to where Bethany or Bataneia can be. So we're going to identify Bataneia. We're going to look at the starting point. Where is it that this trip starts from? It cannot be a trip that takes longer than 2 days. We pictured this in a previous lesson that Bataneia is the area of the Golan Heights and east of there. It has as its southern border the Yarmouk River, then on its western border the Jordan River and the Sea of Galilee. The location where John was baptizing is called Bethany, east or beyond the Jordan. And you might say, well, Bataneia and Bethany do not look like similar words. Well, they are actually quite similar. In Greek, we have Batania is the way that people would say Bataneia, and the way that they would say Bethany was Betania. So Bataneia versus Betania. It does seem as though John's pronunciation, being a Galilean, has the two places being pronounced the same way. Now, let's look at the amount of time that's available. Many people identify a place that's east of the Jordan that's just north of the Dead Sea. So if you look at that first map and you look at the bottom of the blue line, that would be pointing to a place called Betabara. But going from Betabara, going north along that blue line, going north by northwest up to Cana of Galilee would take 3 to 4 days. It's not sufficient time for the allotment that is available for this trip. On the other hand, if Jesus were starting out just east of the Jordan River but close to the Sea of Galilee, whether south of or north of the Sea of Galilee, it's easily done in 1 to 2 days. This also, this location, works better in looking at John 10 through 11. Because there we have what seems to be a four-day journey from the way that John describes it in chapters 10 and 11. But if Betabara, looking at the east end of that little blue line, if that were the location, then Martha would have reason to be angry at Jesus because he took 4 days to make what would be a one-day journey and therefore arrived late, and he could have arrived before Lazarus died. So it has importance here because that is the location, because of it being necessary to make a two-day trip within 2 days rather than somehow doing a four-day trip in 2 days. But it has even more importance for the argument of chapters 10 and 11. So I would argue that the location from which Jesus left was Bataneia. But now that leads us to a third question. Okay, we have 2 days available for the trip and the starting point is Bataneia. But where is Cana? There are three places that have been identified as Cana. Immediately, everyone rejects number one because that is up in Lebanon. It's way too far north. And notice that the Location is called in chapter 2, verse 1, Cana of Galilee. Not Cana of Lebanon, but Cana of Galilee. It cannot be the location way up north in Lebanon. For many, many, many years, people have preferred location 2, Kfar Cana. That location even has a big Greek Orthodox church that's called the Church of the Wedding and so on and so forth. And so tourists tend to go to that place. But in more recent years, people have looked more closely, although there has not been much archaeological excavation done at Kirbet Cana. But Kirbet Cana, location 3, that's in the red circle, fits things far better. The word Cana means reed, as in, you know, like tule grass, you know, that grows in swamps, or as in Egypt, the papyrus. Well, Cana would refer to reeds that would grow in a swampy area. And just below the hill on which Kirbet Cana is located is an area that had reeds. And that, so, by the way, Kirbet is a word that means a ruin. And I'll show some pictures that will show what that place looks like today. Notice I have a map on the lower left, Kirbet Cana, Kfar Cana, and then Nazareth, and to give an orientation in relation to the Sea of Galilee. I favor Kirbet Cana. I think that the linguistic evidence and the geographic evidence favors that to be the location. The oval is showing where it's located. It's not at the very peak of that hill, but it's down somewhat where it's a little more level part way up the hill. Now notice the fields that are cultivated. Yeah. And so as you look at the picture that is in the upper right, we are looking the opposite direction and we are looking down, and you can see foundations for buildings and so on and so forth. This location fits the descriptions. And by the way, Josephus indicates that he made it his headquarters for a period of time during the fight against Rome. If we look at the aerial photograph in the lower right, the oval is there picturing that area where you see the synagogue and that perhaps became a church, the south structure and the north structure. And that, so that's the main location of Kirbet Cana. That would be the location to which Jesus went. It's easily doable in a two-day trip. It is a little over 30 miles, so it would be easily doable in 2 days. So that then helps us establish where Jesus came from to make this trip, that it's possible to do it within 2 days, and he ends up at Kirbet Cana. We have another introductory issue, and that is that we have stone water jars. Take a look at verse 6. Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Judeans, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. It is very important that these are stone rather than these being made out of pottery, being made out of clay. These are actually stone, it's chalk stone, and a couple of quarries have been located, a couple up in Galilee and one down in Jerusalem. And a fascinating thing that has emerged is that the only places where stone vessels were used were by Jews. If when they're looking at archaeological sites, they find from the time of Herod in through the up until the time of the Roman destruction of Jerusalem, if what they find are stone vessels, they know it's a Jewish settlement. They don't find these in Gentile usage. It's only in Jewish usage, and there's an important reason for that. Specifically, Leviticus chapter 11, verses 32 and 33 says that if a vessel that's made out of earth, that is a clay vessel, normal pottery, becomes unclean in certain ways, it was to be broken. And that, in part, accounts for why one finds so many broken pieces of pottery throughout Israel. It's not just that they were broken accidentally or when a building collapsed or during a war or things like that. They also were intentionally broken because they had become ceremonially unclean. But that same passage in Leviticus says that unclean items of wood, cloth, and leather or skin are to be put into water. That is, you could wash them. But, you know, you wouldn't make much money in Israel if you advertised yourself as a dishwasher. Because rather than washing dishes, they tend to break the dishes. But someone came up with an idea about the time that Herod the Great came into power that they could save a lot of breakage if they had stone. Because notice, the passage in Leviticus says nothing about what to do with stone. So they said, well, since it doesn't say what to do, we'll treat it like it's wood, cloth, or leather. We'll wash it. We'll put it in water rather than breaking it. And so it became a cost savings method for Jewish people to use stone vessels. There are a couple of YouTube videos that show how they were made and so on and so forth. I'll have a couple of things here to show on that. What you see in the upper left is what was going to be a drinking cup. It has not yet had the core removed, and it has not had a hole placed where you would put your finger through to hold it, as in like a coffee cup. When you look at the upper right, you can see this quarry and factory where there were partially finished stone vessels that are there just lying loosely. When you look at the bottom picture, you'll see on the right-hand side, things that were being made into cups, but then you notice those little cylinders. It actually turns out that those were lathed out of the cups or the bowls in order to make them. You would think, well, at that period of time, how would they cut that? And you're imagining them carving them out. But actually, what was used were lathes. We can demonstrate lathes being in use in Egypt. I'll show some lathes of what they looked like. But what I have at the far right is a piece of stoneware that was broken because of a building collapse, not an intentional breakage, but if you had that as a complete circle, it would be the size of the vessels that are described here in John 2:6 that would hold 20 or 30 gallons. These would be very expensive. And my suspicion is that these were not owned by a family, but they might have been owned by the synagogue, and the synagogue might have been where the reception was for this wedding feast. And so these would be very expensive, and they're expecting to have a large number of people, so they need lots of water there for the purification. But let's look at the lathes. On the right-hand side is a depiction that appears in an Egyptian tomb of one of their lathes. Normally, they would have been used for woodworking. And so one person would hold the piece that is being tooled, and the other has a bow, as in a bow and arrow, with the string wrapped around the piece that's to be tooled, and he moves his arm back and forth, and that causes this spindle to turn back and forth, and while that's happening, a blade is held up against it in order to do the work. If you look on the left, there's a reconstruction of one of those, and then at the upper left, I have how it is that the cord would be placed in order to cause the rotary motion. I have seen demonstrations where people have made cores out of granite, and as you know, there in Colorado, granite is very tough, and you'd say, how in the world would they manage to get through granite with the types of materials that they might be able to make as a cylinder that's going back and forth like this? Well, if you have some sand and you have some water, it turns out that even as soft a material as bronze is able to work its way through granite. In Egypt, there are works that were cut that show the little marks that would be left behind by a lathe of this type, and so on and so forth. And furthermore, in the vessels that were produced at these various factories, the two in Galilee and the one in Jerusalem that have been discovered, all of those had these marks that would be consistent with it being lathe cut. But furthermore, when you look at those cores, you'll notice that there are little lines that are going around circular. That would be the type of mark that is left behind as it is cut with a lathe. And so then when it's reached the bottom, then you basically put a wedge and hit it with a hammer, and hopefully it is the core that breaks out instead of breaking the cup. So these would be expensive to manufacture. A lot of handwork went into them, took a lot of time, but since the law required the breaking of clay vessels if they became contaminated, for ritual purification purposes, they wanted stone. And John 2:6 is the earliest mention of this particular feature, but archaeologists have noticed the stone vessels in Jewish settlements as they've dug around for things from the 1st century BC and the 1st century AD. Okay, let's talk a little bit about Judean ritual purification. In Israel, there are many mikvahs, or the plural would be mikvaot, and the water would be in this, and there would be steps to get down there. And the reason for having a number of steps is that often these would be pools that would fluctuate as to how high the water was. So if the water is low, you go further down, and if it's higher, you don't have to go down as many steps in order to immerse. But there were all sorts of ritual purifications for people, as well as for items of clothing and utensils, and so on and so forth. So here at this wedding, there would have been a great deal of hand washing that would have occurred. People were very concerned about ritual contamination. And so Jesus is going to do out with the old and in with the new. The title for this message was Rinse Water into Fine Wine. I mean, this was water that ultimately would be dumped out, that would be in these vessels, the six vessels holding between 20 and 30 gallons each. Okay, that now brings us
to...
Can I ask a question? Yeah.
Earlier you stated that the vessels would have been Jewish vessels versus Gentile. In the last slide, you were talking about Judean versus Samaritan, or can you just clarify between those?
Okay, very good. The Gospel of John has one issue that has arisen is, what does John mean when he says the word eudaios? Does he mean Jew, or does he mean Judean? And I would argue, as we're going to do within this passage, that from the usage of this term, which appears 70 times in John's Gospel, that he is referring to Judeans rather than to Jews. Judeans would be from the southern tribes, and Jesus, of course, being a Judean, his parents being Judean, there was a Judean enclave up in Galilee. The reason that I insist on it being rendered as Judean is because that's how John uses the term throughout. As we argued, there are six disciples in John chapter 1. Andrew, Peter, John is not named, but and Nathanael is in the other Gospels called Bartholomew, which means son of Ptolemy, so it's Ptolemy would be the name of his father. So Nathanael was Bartholomew's actual name, but he was also called son of Ptolemy. Okay, the possibility exists, and we talked about this, I'm not going to go into detail on it, that the Apostle John and James could be cousins of Jesus. That is rather attractive to me. I think a good case can be made for it, but we can't be absolutely dogmatic about it. Here's what that yields. If we look at the groupings of the six disciples, plus, of course, Mary being there, which we're told that she was there, and then Jesus and his disciples were invited, question becomes, well, why were his disciples invited? Well, Mary seems to have a significant role in the wedding, in the sense that, first of all, she raises the issue that they've run out of wine, but secondly, she tells the servants that do whatever he says to do. Seems like she has an official position. That suggests that it may well be a relative of hers or a relative of Joseph's that is getting married. She has traveled from Nazareth to Cana, so she has made a bit of a trip. We have then James and John that are identified as brothers, and Peter and Andrew are brothers, but the four of them are associates, that is, they work together in the Zebedee's fishing business. But with James and John being Jesus' cousins, a very good possibility that Peter and Andrew were also known to Jesus' family. Philip is from Bethsaida, but he is always closely associated with Bartholomew or Nathanael in each of the accounts. Nathanael is from Cana, the town here where the wedding is taking place. There is a very good possibility that all of them were known to each other. Now, that makes it necessary to ask and answer one question. We have Nathanael saying, when Jesus proclaimed him to be an Israelite in whom there's no guile, he says, "How do you know me?" What he's saying is, how do you know my character? We are not close friends. We haven't spent a lot of time together. How do you know me? It's not necessarily a statement of, I have never met you. I have no idea who you are. We've also had John the Baptist saying that he did not know Jesus. But as we explained last time and the time before, he was a relative of Jesus, as is evident because his mother and Mary were related, and Mary went down and was with Elizabeth until just shortly before John was born. And yet he said he didn't know Jesus. What he meant was he didn't know Jesus as the Christ. He's not saying, I didn't ever meet him. I have no idea who he is. It does seem that the Judean community in Galilee was a fairly tight-knit community. We see that because in John chapter 6, when Jesus is in a synagogue, there are people at that synagogue that indicate that they know both Joseph and Mary, and not only Jesus, but his siblings. Well, his sisters undoubtedly would have already been married, and that by the time the family moved to Capernaum, and for them to say that they knew even them is indication of, it really is a fairly tight-knit community, despite the fact that the Judeans that were in Galilee lived in various towns around Galilee. So it would not surprise me if they are known to each other. Why is this important? Many people have suggested that essentially Jesus' disciples barged in on the wedding, and the fact that they were there is the reason that they ran out of wine. But actually, in point of fact, the text says that they were invited. That not only Jesus was invited, but his disciples were invited. Meaning that they might have been at that wedding whether or not they had met Jesus when they were down with John the Baptist. Apparently, they were going to head back up the hill from Sea of Galilee region and come to the wedding. They were invited. It isn't just that it's because Jesus was invited that they tagged along. Okay, so now we can actually get into the passage proper, since we've set up a lot of the preliminary issues. We have in verses 1 and 2, on the third day a wedding occurred in Cana of Galilee. Now Jesus' mother was there. Both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. So the way that it's structured, it gives indication that invitations were extended to the disciples. It's not just that they tagged along with Jesus. And furthermore, with regard to the issue of the running out of wine, whole towns were invited for the wedding feasts, and they could last as long as a week. So families made quite a provision in order to have the food and the wherewithal for people, and it would be quite an embarrassing social faux pas for them not to have enough wine. Okay, Jesus' mother is there, and Jesus and his disciples were also invited. Now, Jesus' mother said to him, they don't have wine. And that would be a major issue and so forth. That was something that simply was not done in social events. You always made sure that you had sufficient wine for the purpose, for the occasion. But now in verse 4, my translation, ma'am, Jesus said to her, ma'am, what is the concern to me and to you? My hour is not yet come. It's often been said that Jesus is rather abrupt and rather rude to his mother, but later occasions in the book, such as when he's on the cross, he deals very tenderly with his mother and he calls her there also woman. I would suggest that to get the idea of the nuance, our translation, ma'am, which now that we're down in Tennessee, we hear that a lot. It's yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. And I mean, people are very polite. And
we call the dog Miss Keeter.
Yeah, Diane pointed out our dog's nickname is Keeter, but we have southernized her and we call her Miss Keeter. Now you say it really fast, Miss Keeter. So, oddly enough, though, we haven't had many mosquitoes. I was expecting that we would have a lot of mosquitoes, but we do have a Miss Keeter. Anyway, besides the use of woman, something else appears to have been lost in translation. In the sense, it looks rather rude. You know, what is the concern to me and you? It's essentially saying, I'm not interested in your problem. I mean, that's what it sounds like. It sounds rude. It sounds abrupt. But that is definitely not the case, because what is Mary's response in the next verse? His mother told the servants, whatever he tells you, do. Oh, by the way, that reminds me of one of the further arguments that Mary may well be related to John. We're indicating that she may well be the author's aunt. One of the things that's very interesting is that John, as he writes the book, never names immediate family members. He doesn't name himself. He doesn't name his brother James, and he doesn't name Mary either, which has been suggested by many that it may point out that she is indeed his aunt. But why is it that Jesus says, my hour has not yet come? Well, it is December 31st and the ball is almost ready to drop there in Times Square. We say the hour is not come. It's indicating it's coming. It's fixing to pretty soon. Well, Jesus says this same phrase a number of times. There are two other passages that I did not include, John 7:6 and John 7:8, where he uses a different word instead of my hour. It's my season. And I take it there that he's saying his time for going up to Jerusalem for the feast had not yet come. Let's look at these passages. Jesus says repeatedly, his time has not yet come. He does that in 2:4. Go ahead to John chapter 7, verse 6, I mean 7, verse 30. And says, the officials, sought to take him or arrest him, but no one laid a hand on him, because his hour had not yet come. John chapter 8, verse 20, he is being heckled. And what we're told is these words, the preceding words, Jesus spoke in the treasury as he taught in the temple, and no one laid hands on him, for his hour had not yet come. But there will be a change, a significant change at 12:23. And in that passage, instead of Jesus saying that it has not yet come, he now says it has come. But Jesus answered them, saying, "The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified." This is Palm Monday. This is early in the week in which he was crucified. Look at 13:1. "Now before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew that the hour had come that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end." Again, it's saying his hour has come. And look at chapter 17, verse 1. Jesus spoke these words, lifted up his eyes to heaven, and said, "Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that your Son may also glorify you." What is it that he's referring to? Why is it that up until chapter 7, chapter 12, that his hour has not yet come, but then starting in chapter 12, it has come? There's a prophecy in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through 27, and we have discussed this previously. It is on Message of Life on our website. We have posted messages on this passage. It sets forth a timetable. And that timetable is talking about 490 years, or 70 weeks of years, that God would be working with the nation of Judah in order to prepare it for the return of the Messiah and the establishment of the millennial kingdom. Essentially, Daniel was praying in Daniel 9, "Wow, I read in Jeremiah that after 70 years of captivity, we would be able to return to Jerusalem. Lord, are you indicating that at this time you're going to fulfill all the promises made to Abraham?" And the answer to him was, "Well, not quite. There are 490 years of me working with the nation to accomplish six things that are described in verse 24 in preparation for fulfilling the promises made to Abraham and the establishment of the kingdom." A fascinating thing is that when one works out the timetable, the first 483 years came to a conclusion. And it says that Messiah the Prince will come. And when is it that that date was happened? It was the date of Palm Monday when Jesus entered into Jerusalem. John chapter 12 and the other Gospels all talk about his entrance, his triumphal entrance. And that happened on Palm Monday. It was the day that the 69th heptad, or the 69th week, or the 483rd year was accomplished. Now these are 360 day years, which is the length of time in a Jewish prophetic year. But after that, Daniel 9 says, after he's been presented, after he's come as prince, then he would be cut off. He would be put to death. And so on that very day, in John chapter 12, verse 23, Jesus said, "The hour has come." In other words, it's possible now for him to be crucified, because Daniel's first 483 years of the prophecy had been fulfilled that very day that Jesus spoke that. So, what does that mean here as we're back in John chapter 2, verse 4? Mary knows that Jesus is very special. He was not born in the ordinary way. Mary knows full well that he was virgin born. She also knows that God had spoken through the angel Gabriel to her and indicated all sorts of wonderful things that Jesus would do and that he would be the Messiah. So naturally, she would come to him and say, Jesus, we've got a problem. Houston, we've got a problem. And his response is, I'm not working on your timetable, Mother. I'm working on my Father's timetable. Note how that's akin to what Jesus said in Luke chapter 2 when he was in the temple at age 12. And Joseph and Mary were searching for him. And his response when Mary said, you know, you've really put us through the ringer. He said, did you not know that I must be about my Father's business? His heavenly Father, rather than entering the artisan trade of his adopted father, Joseph. Well, Mary would know that very special things were going to happen, and you know, she's kind of anxious for him to reveal himself. You know, this is a time to do that. And he says, no, I'm functioning on my Father's timetable, and it's not time for me to be revealed. So Jesus does a sign, but the sign is done, shall we say, semi in private. No one actually saw the water turning into wine. They just knew that it happened and that Jesus had not touched the vessels. So, he's saying, this is not exactly our concern here at the moment, and it's not time for me to reveal myself. This is not rude. He is not saying, I will not do this at all. I will not. Yeah, he's not saying that. He's saying, I will do this on my Father's timetable. As Father's timetable and his Mother's timetable, that is his Heavenly Father's and Mary's timetable, we're pretty close. But Jesus has established that he's taking orders from the Father, which he does throughout the Gospel of John. And his mother clearly did not see this as Jesus saying, no way, not going to do anything. Because what she said to the servants was, whatever he tells you, do. She's giving indication, okay, Jesus is going to do something. You servants, you need to follow exactly what he says. She's in a position of authority here, which suggests that she's a relative of the person that's getting married. And so she gives them orders, and they seem to follow through just fine. In verse 6, now we come to the stone water pots. And this is in the Israel Museum, where they have some of the large stone pots. They were placed there according to the Judean purification rites, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Now again, if this were not in John's Gospel, I'd be quite happy to translate this Jewish, because it was within Jewish settlements that we find the stone vessels. But the family is Judean, and John uses the word Judaios to refer to Judeans. Let me, I indicated that I made that as an assertion, but let's take a look at John chapter 3, verse 22. We have a bit of a paraphrase in every translation where it says in 3:22, after these things, Jesus and his disciples came into the land of Judea. Now you'll notice, well, let's see, actually I don't have that translated here in the notes, but literally it would be in the Judean countryside, and that is how the Living Water translation handles it. Judean is an adjective. And there was no such thing as the Jewish land. That would be called Israel. But there is a tribal region for Judah, and there was also the Roman province called Judea. And this would be a way of referring to the within the province of Judea. Now turn to John chapter 7, verse 1. We have one other use here of the term eudaios, which, as I said, is used 70 times in John's gospel. It says, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea, because the eudaioi sought to kill him. Now, the issue there is, Judeans live in the land of Judea, or at least that's where their ancestry came from. In the case of Jesus, although he lived most of his life in Galilee, he was born in Judea, in Bethlehem of Judea, to Judean parents. And despite the fact that they lived in Galilee, they were Judean ethnically and in terms of where each of them had been born. Okay, Jesus then tells the servants, fill the jars with water, and they filled them to the top. It's very important that they're filled to the top. This gives indication that the turning of water into wine was not because some addition was given. They were filled up to the very top with water. There's no room for any other ingredients. Furthermore, you notice Jesus is giving instructions for the servants to do it. Jesus is not touching these vessels. He is not touching them. He's not having an opportunity to put something in there. The sign, the miracle that he does not require him to physically touch this. Oh, by the way, let me explain something here in the next passage, and it's appeared before this. You'll see dots, such as by the word draw and bring.
Yeah, that's
right. These indicate that the word is a plural form, so he commanded the servants, plural. And that's so whenever you see the dot by a verb, it's indicating that it's a y'all, as we say down here in the South, and it is plural. So he told them, draw some out and bring it to the master of ceremonies. So they brought it. Now, a lot of interpreters want to say that, well, they're not drawing the water out of the these 20 to 30 gallon containers, but they actually drew it out of a well, because the word for drawing is the word that's used for drawing out of a well. Okay, fine and good. But are you going to pick up a 20 or 30 gallon stone container and tip it in order to pour water out? I think not. How are they going to get it? They're going to dip it with a cup. They're doing the same type of action on a smaller scale, as I've illustrated with the person that's dipping with a cup. It's like dipping with a bucket. So it's not talking about them drawing water from the well, even though the word that's used would normally be used for drawing it out of a well, but it's the motion of scooping up the water that the verb is referring to. So the servants have gone and they have drawn water out by dipping with a cup and putting it into another cup that they then hand to the master of ceremonies. I would assume that as they're doing this, it's just water, and they're thinking, oh my, we're going to be bringing water to the master of ceremonies. Is he going to be upset with us? And now what's being depicted here is pouring of wine out into the glass. Who knows exactly when the transformation happened? This would be a logical time for it to have happened. And you can imagine if that were the case, the servants looking and saying, we put water in here. What gives? This doesn't look like water anymore. So they brought it. They gave it to the master of ceremonies. Now in verse 9. When the master of ceremonies tasted the water which had become wine and did not know where it was from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of ceremonies called the groom. The master of ceremonies turns first to the groom. Where did this come from? He would certainly have known that they had run out of wine. By the way, the term that is here translated master of ceremonies is Lord of the Triclinium. This would be a special occasion when people would have reclined. We'll have more to say about reclining. We've talked about that at a few points already here in this series. But what is it that he then says? Why is it that he calls the groom? Verse 10, he's puzzled. He told him, every man sets out the fine wine first, then the inferior, when guests have imbibed, but you have kept the fine wine until now. People would try to impress others by having the best wine that they could afford first, and then when people's taste buds weren't quite as acute, then they'd serve what was cheaper, and so on and so forth. But this is so much better than the wine that was there initially that the master of ceremonies makes quite a commotion over it, and the groom has no idea. He's in the dark too. You can imagine, they started to say, okay, well, I guess we need to ask the servants. They were handling it. Where did you get this from? And they'd say, well, Jesus told us to fill these purification vats here with water, and we filled it clear up, and he told us to bring some to you, and as we brought it, well, lo and behold, it wasn't water anymore, it was wine, and you said it was fine wine. And so, okay, next question, Jesus, tell us what happened. And I can imagine Jesus explaining this, and as Zane Hodges indicated, 120 gallons of fine wine, they may not have consumed it all. And that could have been quite a spectacular wedding gift to this groom and his wife there that they would have been able to sell, and it would have been something that would have funded them very nicely. Who knows? The text doesn't tell us, but that's a possibility. But notice the very fact that everything has been done out of order makes it so that the master of ceremonies starts asking questions. And that set of questions would logically lead to something miraculous has happened here. A transformation has happened. Something that can't be done by ordinary people. Something that could only be done by Messiah. The millennial kingdom that Jesus is going to establish is very often compared to a banquet. And there will be the millennial banquet, the marriage feast, that will be within the millennium and will be a special honor for those that are invited. Not all believers are going to be invited. It's only those that are pleasing to the Lord as they conduct their lives, where their life has served and glorified the Lord. But the fact that those types of comparisons are made by Scripture, Jesus may be anticipating this. He is doing something new. It's not the rinse water anymore. It's the new wine, the fine wine, that seems to be an anticipation of what he as Messiah is going to do, as he's able to instantaneously transform water into wine. Ordinary grade wine takes a number of years of cultivating and all the process of caring for plants, and yet Jesus was able to do this instantaneously on the spot. Each of the signs in John's gospel is pointing to him as the Messiah, the one who grants everlasting life to those who believe him for it. In verse 11, we are told, Jesus did this as the first of his signs in Cana of Galilee, and he displayed his glory. I've listed the eight signs that are here within John's gospel. John tells us in that purpose statement, John 20, verses 30 and 31, that these signs are proof that Jesus is who he says he is. No one but Messiah could do what he did. And that validates his words. He spoke words that no one could legitimately speak except Messiah. This is the opening sign. This is the one that gets things rolling. Jesus has been accumulating disciples in John chapter 1 who now can testify of this sign and of the other seven signs that are recorded in John in order to verify to unbelievers this is indeed the life-giving Messiah, that if you believe in him for everlasting life, guess what? You've got everlasting life. Now it says that he displayed his glory. Every time Jesus did a sign, he displayed his glory. He showed that he is indeed God in the flesh. Look back at John chapter 1, verse 14. The Word, member of the Trinity, became flesh and tabernacled us among us. That would be a literal rendering. And we beheld his glory. Glory is the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. The glory that the disciples witnessed was when he did signs, when he proved that he is the messianic Son of God, when he showed that he is part of the Godhead. He's not just man, but he's the God-man. He's the Messiah. He's the King of Israel. He's the one who gives life to believers. He displayed his glory. This is the first instance where the disciples saw him manifesting his glory. And his disciples believed in him. Now the question becomes, when John says his disciples believed in him, is he saying, right now, at this moment in time, these six disciples came to faith in Jesus? I think not. What John is saying is that these six were believers. They were ones who had believed in him. Chapter 1, when we look at Andrew saying, we have found the Messiah. And when we see Philip saying, we have found the one of whom Moses and the prophets wrote. And when Nathanael said, you are the King of Israel, Son of God. Those testimonies are testimonies of faith. They are believing that Jesus is that very one that John the Baptist that we have said is like a pointer dog. He's always pointing to Jesus. And you remember in the prologue to John, it said that God sent John the Baptist to give testimony so that through him all might believe. What happens when people believe? They receive eternal life. John had been testifying of Jesus. He had been testifying of that coming one. And then when Jesus returned from his baptism and temptation, John was testifying to the one who was in their very presence, the Messiah. And so these six disciples, who were disciples of John, had come to believe in Jesus. They were already believers. And the statement here, his disciples were believers. That's the point. Let me confirm that as we go to the next verse. I think the next verse will help us see something. Now, it's very interesting. When Jesus went to Capernaum, that has now become his new headquarters after rejection in Nazareth, it says, after this, his mother, his brothers, and his disciples went down to Capernaum, but they did not remain there many days. Well, we've already seen that his mother was there, and we've been told in verse 11 that his disciples believed in him, so clearly his disciples were there. But now we have another group that's mentioned, his brothers. Now it's approximately 30 miles to go from Cana of Galilee to Capernaum. It's about a two-day trip. What would you imagine they would have talked about as they were going to Capernaum?
The weather.
Yeah, Diane said maybe they were talking about the weather. No, I think not. They would have been talking about what Jesus did in providing all of that wine out of what had been rinse water. His disciples were believers. His mother was a believer. What about those brothers? Approximately 2.5 years later, John chapter 7:5 says that not even his brothers believed in him. His brothers knew that Jesus had turned water into wine, but they just couldn't get past, big brother, he always seems to be perfect, and mom and dad are always talking about, it would be so nice if you would be as obedient as Jesus. And they're tired of that comparison. And they just can't get past that. And there they are. And they're still 2.5 years later, unbelievers. I think this is a preview introducing us to the brothers, saying they had plenty of opportunity to see that Jesus was indeed who he says he was. Now, when we look at the book of Acts, we find out after the resurrection of Jesus, they were believers. They became believers then, but they were not prior to his crucifixion and resurrection. We're told that they went down to Capernaum. Here would be the approximately 30-mile trip. And by the way, there is a walking path to be able to make that entire trip. And it has in recent years been marked. So they've got it all marked out so that people do hike that trail between Capernaum and actually Nazareth. It goes the additional miles on to Nazareth. Here is Capernaum. We have a view of the white synagogue. As you look at it, the lower courses of stone that are darker, that are basalt, date from the first century. Jesus spoke undoubtedly in that synagogue, which in the picture on the right is in the foreground. That oval or round-shaped building, or perhaps octagonal building, is where the Catholics that run this think was Peter's house. And I used to be suspicious, used to not think that a very good case could be made for that, but I think it's not at all unlikely that it was Peter's house. We'll talk about that at another time when we're looking at passages in Capernaum. But what we have seen here is Jesus had accumulated disciples. Those disciples were already believers. They've given, at least three of them have given testimonies concerning Jesus, and that's their purpose. That's why Jesus has gathered them, so that with the purpose statement of John, that they would be able to testify that indeed Jesus has done these signs, and he is indeed the Messiah, the Son of God. This is the first of his signs. Jesus did it after he had accumulated some disciples. He doesn't have all 12. We know that he doesn't have Matthew, and Judas never believed, so I would doubt that Judas had become a follower of Jesus by this time. A statement is made that his disciples were believers. So Judas would not have been a disciple at that point. But by doing the transformation of rinse water into fine wine, Jesus anticipated what he's going to do in the millennial kingdom. He is one who can transform. And he's one able to also to give life to those who are dead. All people are born without spiritual life. The Gospel of John does not treat the unbeliever as being alive, but as one who is dead spiritually, needing to receive life, life from God. And that's only received by believing Jesus for his promise of everlasting life. Through the signs, he proves that he is who he says he is, and he has the power to do all that he promises, and what Jesus says always comes true. When he promises everlasting life, at the moment that a person believes in him for everlasting life, guess what? That new believer at that moment has everlasting life. Any questions?
John, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Two questions related to Palm Monday. Palm Monday is the end of the 69th Haftad, according to the book of Daniel, right?
Yes.
How much earlier was the wedding than the Palm Monday?
Okay, good question. The next week, not next week since we're not meeting next week, but the following week when we meet, I'll be talking about the temple cleansing passage. That passage is going to give us reason to date the overall flow of the Gospel of John. So this is just in anticipation of what I'll be saying in greater detail on that. But when Jesus was in Jerusalem for Passover, it was Passover of the year 30. So AD 30 is John 2. His crucifixion was at Passover in AD 33. So 3 years have transpired. Let me tell you what the feature is that enables us to date John 2. The text in no English translation translates one of the verses precisely. If you look at John chapter 2, verse 20, the Judean said, and this is New King James, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" There are three problems in that verse. First one is it shouldn't say Jews, it should say Judeans. Second problem is it's not a literal translation when they say it has taken 46 years to build this. Literally what it says is this sanctuary has been built 46 years. Josephus gives us the date when the sanctuary was begun. You'll notice I'm rendering it sanctuary and not temple. There's a reason for that. When you look at John chapter 2, verse 14, it says, "And he found in the temple." That word refers to the temple precincts. It's the word hieron. We get the word hierarchy and so on and so forth from that, but it's a word that should be rendered the temple precincts. It's looking at the outer portion, not at the holy place and the holy of holies. But in verse 19 and verse 20, it's not the same word. It's not the word temple. It's the word naos, which is sanctuary, and it's a reference to the holy place and holy of holies. Josephus tells us that the temple precincts, the hieron, was built with common labor. In other words, ordinary people from any tribe of Israel could work on building the temple precincts. But for building the sanctuary, he tells us that the only workers on that were the Levites, which is in keeping with what their role was supposed to be, that they were the ones that took care of the sanctuary, whether it's of the tabernacle in the Old Testament or the temple in the Old Testament. So Josephus differentiates between this sanctuary and the temple precincts, just like John does, using the same words to differentiate it. So we have plenty of evidence that gives indication that the sanctuary was completed 46 years before 30. So that passage enables us to date John chapter 2, starting at verse 13. I don't imagine that the wedding was very long before Passover, so but we don't have a clear indication of time, but it could not have been more than 6 months before, because Jesus was baptized approximately 6 months before that Passover. So John chapter 7, we're able to date it because it's the Feast of Tabernacles prior to him being crucified. John gives us a lot of details that enable us to date things. Without John, we wouldn't be able to date a lot of the events in Jesus' life very precisely.
My second question, you refer to Palm Monday. I know we've gone over this before. Why is it Palm Monday instead of Sunday? Can you repeat that?
Okay, let's go to John 12. The first thing, as we note, the reason that people have taken it as Palm Sunday is they look at the dating of verse 1, then 6 days before the Passover. So you count backwards from Friday, of his crucifixion, and they say, okay, we've got here Sunday. Sure enough, we have Sunday. So it says, then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he raised from the dead. There they made him a supper. Now the question becomes, first of all, does it tell us that the supper was served on the same day that he arrived? Well, it doesn't. So the possibility exists that the meal would have been on Sunday, or the meal could be the next day. Saturday or the next day, sorry. But here's the issue, the problem with it being Saturday. I've been saying Sunday, I meant to say Saturday. His arrival would have been on Saturday. He traveled on Sabbath in order to get there. The first problem is, this is a big meal. This is another meal where they reclined. They were not sitting. This is a special meal, and they're reclining at a triclinium. This is a very special meal. This is a big, big deal. They didn't have refrigeration, and they didn't have cell phones. So how is it that they're going to know that Jesus is going to arrive today, and we ought to have this meal for him today, and we need to invite everyone that's going to be part of this and have this big meal where everyone's around a triclinium? Now that's a problem, but it's not the biggest problem. The other difficulty is that what we find is that there were many religiously observant of Jews who were traveling back and forth between Jerusalem and Bethany when they found out that Jesus was there in Bethany, and they were traveling back and forth, and they were religiously observant Jews who were had been associated with the temple and so on and so forth. Would we expect for them to be traveling on a Sabbath? No. So the lack of refrigeration and cell phones and so forth would make it so that it's going to be easier to imagine the meal the day after his arrival rather than upon his arrival. But then the fact that we have religiously observant people that are traveling more than a Sabbath day's journey on a Sabbath, that would be problematic. So then that suggests, no, indeed, the meal was served on Sunday, and then Jesus went the next day into Jerusalem. Interestingly, this solves a little problem that many people have observed, that as one looks at Jesus' final week, every day has activity except one, assuming Palm Sunday. But if it's Palm Monday, it turns out that there's an event, there's an action that occurs and can be dated for every day of that week. And so it resolves a problem that people have said, well, we'd kind of expect to have the whole week filled up because it's the most detailed week of Jesus' life. And lo and behold, if it's Palm Monday instead of Palm Sunday, every single day has an event.
Thank you.
So, getting chronology right and getting some of these things right just requires very detailed analysis of some of these things. And, you know, they're a closer read than we normally do. But if we aren't working really carefully with God's Word, we're going to miss things. And that's why I take the time to try to explain why it is that I reach my conclusions and walk us through the passage so that we can see, okay, how do we get there? What what is it that we find from the text if we really look at the text closely?
That's why we have you, John.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I ask you a question, John?
Sure.
Yeah, you made a good point about Judas, and that Judas could not have been there at that point because it made a comment that, you know, that the disciples had believed in Jesus. But then when you fast forward to John 20, 30, and 31, it says many other signs Jesus did in the presence of his disciples, but it doesn't. And then you get to the epilogue with
yep.
John. This is the disciple who testifies to these things. So could you sort of reconcile, on the one hand, it looks like we have the six without Judas, and then later on in John 15:8, he says, Jesus says to the disciples after Judas was gone, he said, so you, plural, will be my disciples. Could you reconcile all those things? You got the six, you got the 12, you got everything in between. In other words, it seems like in John 20, 30, 31, all the disciples would be possibly thought of seeing every sign, but it doesn't seem to say that.
No, it doesn't require that. And the big issue in John 20, 30, and 31 is that there were at least two or three. I mean, John's gospel, the issue of the need for two or three witnesses comes up both in John 5 and in John 8. And so it's an issue that, that's the thing that John is being careful to assert, is that the book meets the proper evidential standards for testimony.
That's the first time I heard that. That really makes sense.